Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. I called it Focus 580, didn't I? Focus, our telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, filling in for David Inge. You can tell it's been a long time since I've done that. Used to be the fill-in host and producer of the show. Anyway, during this hour of the show, we will talk about preserving your precious family stuff. Photos, paper documents, works of art, that wedding dress you wanted to get stored safely but didn't. Digital stuff, all kinds of things. We have two guests in the studio with us who have been on the show in the past talking about this, experts in so many different areas. Jennifer Hain-Tepper is the head of the Preservation and Conservation Program at the University of Illinois Library, and she's trained as a book and paper conservator, but her current position, she also oversees staff working on the preservation of photographs, audiovisual materials, and digital content held by the library. And Krista D.C. Quinn, she is the collections manager of the Spurlock Museum here on the campus of the University of Illinois. She supervises collections preservation on various types of artifacts, including textiles, general materials, and ethnographic collections, and probably has seen more different kinds of things over at the Spurlock Museum than anyone could possibly imagine. So there are guests this morning, and your questions are welcome. We'll do our best to answer whatever issues, problems, questions you have about caring for your stuff. All you have to do is call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. So feel free to join us. So both of you, thanks so much for doing this again.
Of course. We always enjoy this.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes, and also we have an event to mention coming up this Saturday. That's one thing that is, in addition to the show, a place where people can get their questions answered. Would you talk about that, please?
Absolutely. We're going to be hosting our fourth Preservation Emporium.
Four already?
It is. Four already. Time flies. It's a free public event held at the Spurlock Museum where we have brought together a wide range of experts from around our university but also into the community to be available to anybody who comes in with questions about preserving their family heirlooms, treasures, or other belongings. We've got specialists in books, papers, photographs, textiles, digital documents, analog audiovisual materials.
Archaeological material.
Archaeological insect collections, natural history collections.
Musical instruments.
Yes. So basically anything you have that you feel is worth keeping, we've probably got someone there who's going to be able to take a look at that and talk about its long-term preservation for you.
Okay. And this is Saturday from noon to 4 p.m. at the Spurlock Museum.
Actually, it's 1 to 4.
1 to 4.
Yes.
Oh.
We shortened it this year.
Okay.
So it's 1 to 4.
Okay, great. And there's also a keynote address. It's, in addition to the opportunity to talk with, you and other experts, someone speaking on cemetery preservation.
Correct. Holly Lubinsky, who is a statewide expert on scholar on cemetery preservation and who's done a lot of research on some of the local larger cemeteries, will be speaking about her research in cemetery preservation and monument preservation.
That should be very interesting.
We also will be giving materials away to help preserve your collection, so come on out.
Okay. And I should, by in the interest of full disclosure, say that I'm involved in this event.
So, you are.
So yeah, and I'm there talking about digital media, actually analog and digital mm-hmm. media, but mostly it's digital increasingly.
What you are working with certainly is very digital, but you are one of our experts.
Yes.
Well, it's an increasingly digital world, and that means a lot of different challenges for all of us, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of that during this hour. So in general, people maybe don't think fully about how to care for their things. I mean, what is we have so many different kinds of materials anymore, mm-hmm. From photographs to, books, maybe garments. What are some of the most important things for people to think about in terms of just, I have artwork, I've got photos, what are some of the things that they should really think about?
The number one thing is going to be the environment, Jack. For almost anything that has physical content, moving away from that digital world, but looking at all of our traditional physical things that we cherish, one of the number one ways to preserve things long term is to make sure that you're storing them appropriately in an appropriate environment. Basically, cooler, darker, drier storage is always going to be an advantage, no matter what type of material you're talking about.
Think about where you want to live. So most of the time, people tend to store their things things in attics or basements, which that's you really want to keep them on the main floor where you're living, because the attic usually gets very, very warm, mm-hmm. or the basement can get very damp. And so, but people don't have room for these things, and then they'll go up in that area and they'll find it and it won't be the same anymore. So bring them down mm-hmm. into those areas. If you want to display them, let's make sure that they're not in full sunlight, not near a fireplace so that the soot will impregnate the physical item. You know, those kind of things. So, you know, you want to be able to enjoy your pieces, but you also want to be able to take care of them long term.
Right. It does involve a certain level of curatorship. If you want to be a good holder of your family's history, you have to be involved and engaged with your own objects and look at them periodically. I can't tell you how many people have had things in, say, storage units where, I mean, they went and got maybe a decent storage unit, maybe even an air-conditioned one, but then haven't visited it for 10 years, only to find out that they've had some sort of infestation of wool-eating insects that have decimated a family quilt or a family carpet or something like that. And at that point, the damage is done. You need to play an active role in preservation. Preservation does take work.
It does.
Certainly, you see a lot of different collections at the Spurlock Museum. What are some of the, I mean, this is the ridiculous question to ask. What are some of the biggest challenges in dealing with such a massive array of different types of materials?
Well, for example, we have an ancient Egyptian mummy that we have to deal with. And so that came from a very dry climate and then came into our climate. And so, you know, the challenges are that, you know, we want to make sure that it's, you know, maintained in its environment. So we actually take silica gel, you know, you sometimes get them and says, you know, it's the little thing that says do not eat. We have massive ones that look like loaves of bread that we stack all around it. You don't see it on display, but it keeps the mummy at the climate it was used to. Or, you know, other things come in from the tropics that are very, very wet. You know, and then when they come into our museum, they start desiccating. So you have to imagine that, you know, we have grass skirts that are really, really puffy, and then they just completely dry out when they come here. So, you know, we have to try and maintain an environment. Certain things like metals want really dry environments, but some of those grass skirts really want wet environments, and you have to keep everybody happy, and not all the artifacts want the same thing. So it's finding that balance that right. I find challenging.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, that's a huge challenge for Krista, and people think of library collections as being much more homogenous and easier, but if you really think about the structure of a book, you know, books are not one material either. Flat paper perhaps is, but with books, you've got the ink, but you also have the paper and the glues and the leathers and the cloth. And in older book collections, which are the ones we're, you know, predominantly most concerned about, you also frequently have leather metal hardware on the books. And so you're having, again, this composite object that really needs about 16 different types of environments to make everything happy. And it can be a real challenge, just like Krista.
So those composite objects with the different kinds of materials, different materials react different ways into different climatic conditions.
Indeed. And metal is particularly problematic. Or, well, it's easy if it's all metal, but it always throws a wrench in things when it's a piece of metal on something else.
Yeah. So, for example, in the museum, you can have what's called organic acid interaction. So if you have, like, a biologic, like a leather next to metal, they can react with each other.
Yeah.
And so then the metal corrodes in a really weird way, but you can't, like, for example, disassemble the mask or the book, you need to leave the metal in. So you have to find a way to make those things work together. We call that inherent vice. It's a way in which the artifact actively, how it was built actively means that it's almost destroying itself. For example, you know, a lot of widow's clothing in the 19th century were made with, you know, with a type of metal that actually weighted the silk, but then that actually, that dye actually actively destroys the silk. So there's not much you can do. You just have to kind of keep it in as you know, comfortable environment as possible and not display it very often and be very careful about it. So some artifacts or books have that kind of problem. But then, Jennifer, I'm sure you find that maybe modern books aren't built as well as older books.
Indeed. Actually, although the preservation challenges of older materials are challenging, newer materials sometimes present even greater challenges because of that level of inherent vice that you were already talking about. Newer materials that books are made out of are typically much poorer quality materials than older and tend to show signs of deterioration very, very rapidly. And the binding structures themselves are just not as physically robust. I'm sure everybody listening has had a paperback that has broken upon the first time you crack the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because books just aren't made the way they used to be. So not to mention paper quality. All of us know if you leave a newspaper sitting on your front porch for longer than a few hours, you can see discoloration set in immediately. And that's because of a high level of inherent vice in ground wood pulp paper, which is what we make newsprint out of. And that paper is exceedingly difficult to preserve.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation, and we welcome others. Our guest this morning, Jennifer Hain-Tepper, head of the Preservation and Conservation Program at the University Library at the University of Illinois, and Krista D.C. Quinn, the Collections Manager at the Spurlock Museum. We're talking about preserving your family artifacts. We have a caller waiting, and welcome others, 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone in Atlanta, Illinois, line number four. Good morning.
Good morning. This question's a little bit off the subject, but pertaining to it. If you had an family artifacts, which I have, that you would like to donate to the University of Illinois Library, how would you go about getting in contact with somebody to see if it's an artifact that would be worthwhile and how to make an appointment up to do that?
Sure. It's going to depend on what type of object it is.
It's photographs.
Photographs?
A really famous location in the south of during the turn of the century, the other century, and by a really famous photographer, and it's they're pretty compelling photographs.
Okay. And do they relate to the history or research at the University of Illinois at all, or are they just more culturally significant?
Probably just culture. I don't know what kind of research you're doing, so I have no
sure.
idea how to answer that. But culturally, they're really important. Otherwise, I don't know.
Sure. Well, the reason I ask is that there really are two avenues for integrating gifts of collections into the university library. And one is for any material that pertains to research performed at the—so this is historical research that's performed at the University of Illinois or that relates to the history of the University of Illinois. That material goes to the university archives. However, if it is more valuable material that doesn't directly pertain to the university's history, then that probably should go through our Office of Collections, and they'll work with you to see which areas in the library perhaps that collection best fits in. This sounds like it would be something that would potentially be within our special collections. So I would talk to our associate university librarian for collections,
okay.
And his name is Tom Tepper.
Okay.
And he'd be happy to talk with you about the gift.
Do you have how would I get a hold of Dr. Pepper?
Email probably is the easiest.
I can't do that.
Okay. Then telephone. Do you have an internet? I'm a little
no.
hesitant to start giving out private telephone numbers
okay,
on air.
If I call the U of I...
Let me give you my telephone number, and you can give me a call after the show. How's that work?
Okay, that's
okay.
great.
It's 217-244-5689.
Okay, and about what time would you like me to call?
Whenever. You can leave a voicemail if I'm not in, and I'll get back in touch with
okay,
you.
Okay, very
All right?
good.
Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Thanks for the call. We have another caller waiting. On line number one, someone in Peoria. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes. I had a question about preserving a letter.
Mm-hmm. What kind of question?
Letter from...
You're kind of breaking up there. If you could speak directly into your phone, that would probably help. I'm not sure. We're not hearing you. I'm so sorry. If you want to try to call back, that'd be great. Maybe we can answer the question in very general terms.
A letter that needs to be preserved. Well, let me start with the very general then and see if this fellow calls back if
sure.
he's got specific questions. Generally, other than the cool, dry, dark that we already talked mm-hmm. about, letters really, depending on the type of paper that it's made from, generally are going to benefit from what we call a buffered environment. One of the major processes for paper deterioration is acid decay, and that acid can come from the paper itself, like newsprint, or it can come from the environment, improper storage, even just the CO2 in the air when it mixes with water can actually produce acids. And so if you store your family's paper artifacts in appropriate archival quality materials, they frequently have in them what's called an alkaline reserve, or they're called buffered. And what this means is that, say, a folder, I mean, most of us think of, you know, third cut letter size folders that we file all of our bills and whatnot in, for those of us who still pay bills with paper. those are reasonably okay, but true archival quality folders are actually going to have a buffered salt mixed in with that paperboard that actually absorbs, it wicks away the acids from the paper and dramatically slows down its deterioration. Also, obviously, keeping them in the dark, but putting those folders into a buffered box creates what we call a microclimate, and that actually helps. Even if you've got these in the best storage environment in your house possible, chances are your house is going to experience some fluctuations in temperature and relative humidity, just naturally as your air conditioning kicks on and off, as the humidity rises outside, a rainstorm comes through, whatever. And so having them not only in a folder, but then also in a box, in an interior space, is going to create the safest environment for them, to shelter them from those dramatic changes in temperature and relative humidity. And that's really going to extend their life as well.
And how much would you, I mean, I suppose any, you can't tell how much it'll extend their life, but it's a significant factor.
It is a very significant factor. It really depends on the paper.
Yeah.
Paper with a high inherent vice like ground wood pulp, this will certainly extend it, but it's not going to save it. Good quality paper, you can actually then have this. A good quality paper stored under appropriate conditions has a life expectancy of a minimum of 500 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, it depends on the age of this letter. Some of the other issues that we see with letters also is the quality of the ink and the type of ink that was used in the letter. Very common with older letters dating up until the early 1900s was the use of iron gall ink, which is that kind of sepia brown colored ink that we all think of as, you know, antique letter ink.
Yeah.
And the problem with iron gall ink is that it wasn't mass produced to specific recipes. Basically, you had local ink manufacturers who each had their own little spin on how they were going to make iron gall ink. And there were a lot of additives added to it. And frequently, one of the additives that they added was a high level of acid, because it actually took to the paper faster, because the acid basically bit into the paper. And so what happens is, as that iron gall ink deteriorates over time, the iron particles that are in the ink actually shift, become very acidic, and start to first sink through the paper and then to actually eat through the paper. And so it's really, really important. That buffered environment is critical if you've got iron gall ink, to try to slow down that ink deterioration process. Because unlike the paper deterioration, where overall your paper will start to discolor and then it will start to become brittle, the ink very rapidly will eat through your paper, and that is irreversible damage.
Okay. We have our caller back from Peoria. Let's give another shot here. Line number four. Good morning.
Morning.
Yes.
Sorry, the call was dropped when I moved out of the range, I guess.
Okay.
I heard your response, and I appreciate it. I wanted to just give a few more details. This letter was from the Theodore Roosevelt on White House stationery. It is signed, and the question I had was, would there be any way of storing it and but still displaying it, like in a group meeting place? Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
As far as display goes, there are ways to safely display all ranges of artifacts, you know, and letters are commonly one of them. One of the things you want to be really, really careful with display is light damage. That's really the main concern. I shouldn't say that. There are many concerns with display, but light damage is frequently one of the ones that you need to take certain precautions against, especially for those sorts of documents that are typed up like this one is, with then a handwritten signature, because a lot of times, more frequently modern than perhaps the age of this letter, but a lot of those inks that were used for the signatures have really high light sensitivity. And I've seen numerous ones of these where, because the letter was displayed because it was a piece of pride or history, the letter is still all there, but the signature has completely faded away. And so that's a big concern.
Would an option be perhaps to make a copy of the letter and then display that copy.
Certainly is the safest thing to do, yeah. If you really want to display it, there are certain guidelines that will ensure that you have the best quality display. The number one thing is going to be to make sure that you have UV blocking glass. And that you don't present it in direct sunlight or, for that matter, any direct light. Ideally, you display it somewhere where the lights are infrequently on to try to limit that sort of light exposure. There's also matting and framing materials that you would need to use to ensure long-term preservation, 100% rag, mat board, and making sure that nobody suggests that you dry mount the letter. Mm-hmm. Dry mounting is irreversible and has really serious repercussions as far as long-term preservation goes. So you'd want to talk with someone who does preservation matting and framing to make sure that it's a completely reversible matting job with hinges and that they're using full quality conservation quality materials.
And our listeners need to know that light damage is irreversible.
Correct.
We can't turn back the clock. You can't suddenly make the ink reappear.
I wish we could.
I know, and we can't like take a textile or a piece of clothing and suddenly make it bright again. That
right.
just doesn't happen.
No.
That's very helpful. It's interesting there's two kinds of inks, the one with the signature and the one with the typewriter. Mm. And the other interesting part is the president hand-corrected some typos.
Very thorough.
In a hurry, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Thank you for the call. A couple of callers waiting. We'll get on next to a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question about digital photos. So nowadays, a lot of us only have digital copies of a lot of our photos. If we wanted to preserve them, just knowing computers travel pretty fast, it seems like it makes sense to convert them to a hard copy as one of the techniques for preserving them. But I also know that, you know, inkjets and things like that are not necessarily made to last very long. So can you talk a little bit about how we would preserve modern photos in a physical form, or how to print them so that they will last longest?
Sure. That is a really critical question, actually, and one that a lot of people, even those of us who work in preservation, are dealing with because we all have digital cameras.
Right.
My best advice with digital image preservation is to hedge your bets. There is no one way that is absolutely going to ensure that they're all there for the rest of time because, you know, as Krista and I were saying, I mean, all materials deteriorate, not just digital, so even printing them out isn't a fail-safe, but it is a good tool in the toolbox. I do know that I still print out a good number of our photos as my preservation copies. Generally, what you want to do is to shy away from inkjet prints, as you've cited, especially home inkjet, which are the lowest quality inkjets. Have them printed professionally. The quality of the prints that you send out that are not the 1 hour prints, but actually ones that would be processed overnight off site, tend to be considerably higher than the 1 hour, which is still a better quality inkjet than a home inkjet, but is still an inkjet print. If you can actually work with a professional photographic shop, they're going to be able to work with you to get the best quality photographic prints. There are many different processes available out there for printing out digital photographs, and some are more preservation friendly than others, but all of them have problems. None of them are as stable as a traditional photograph, unfortunately. Generally, if you can, although it costs a pretty penny, if they're truly photographs that you want to keep for a very long time, using inks that are pigment-based as opposed to dye-based are going to be your best bet. And for us, in preservation and conservation, when we do photo documentation, which is a record of how we've altered an object in conservation treatment, which we are ethically bound to keep forever, we make sure that our photo documentation is printed out using pigment-based ink. But you do have to really talk with whoever's providing your photographic print service to see if they have that capability, and it's not something that a lot of places are going to have. Also, what you really should do is looking at backing up your hard drive and making sure that you have at least an external hard drive that backs up regularly, not just when you choose to do it, but hopefully has an automatic backup service. You can look at cloud computing as well. There are a lot of cloud backups, but there are some privacy issues that get a little sticky when you start looking in the cloud. I will say that just mounting your photos up on Flickr is a great access mechanism, but certainly isn't the same as backing them up. So looking at how many ways can you store them. Ideally, hard drives are better than any sort of static storage media. Thumb drives are awful as far as corruption goes. CDs and DVDs, unfortunately, aren't too much better. So you really want to look at a good quality hard drive backup.
there's a saying, many copies keeps stuff safe.
Correct.
And really, that's the only, in the digital world, the only way to preserve something is the commitment to
duplicate
it and migrate as the technology changes. And it's changing really fast. So that's one of the challenges.
Absolutely.
Does that get your question?
Great answers. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We're about at our midpoint. We have another call waiting. We would be happy to take others. We have plenty of time left with our two guests, Jennifer Hain-Tepper, head of the Preservation and Conservation Program at the University Library at the University of Illinois, and Krista D.C. Quinn, Collections Manager at the Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about preserving your family artifacts. We will continue. We'll take another call and welcome others. But first, we'll take a short break and come back after this.
Support comes from Charleston Community Theater and Wesley United Methodist Church in Charleston, presenting Godspell, Friday, April 20th and Saturday, April 21st at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, April 22nd at 2 p.m. at the Wesley United Methodist Church in Charleston. Proceeds benefit the Charleston Food Pantry. Details at charlestoncommunitytheater.org.
And this is Focus from WILL. We're talking this morning about preserving your family artifacts with Jennifer Hain-Tepper, head of Preservation and Conservation Program at the University of Illinois Library, and Krista D.C. Quinn, Collections Manager at the Spurlock Museum. We have several callers waiting and time for others if you would like to join us. The phone number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you hear us, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a Champaign listener next on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question just for information. I have my grandmother's DAR certificate. I'm just wondering, is this something that I should cherish and hand on to my daughter?
I mean, that's really your own decision. I mean, that is certainly...
Is it worth keeping?
There is very little monetary value in it,
I was thinking more of the value of her having belonged to that when she did.
There's a certain amount of historical value, certainly. I mean, there are not a lot of people who can claim lineage back to the Revolution. I myself actually am a descendant of a DAR member and have one of those certificates in my family as well. And though I will admit that perhaps politically I don't always agree with some of the politics of many members of the DAR, I consider it a real honor and would certainly hate to lose that piece of history in my family. I'm a strong believer that if you question it, it probably should be saved because there's obviously something about it that's making you think twice.
All I know is that in order to do this, she had to trace our family history back to the Green Mountain Boys.
Yeah, and it is not an insignificant feat to become a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution. And so I think it's an important piece of family history. I think it's definitely worth preserving. And they're beautiful certificates, too.
Yes, it is. So I should just take care of it and hand it on to my daughter.
I think so.
I don't worry about her knowing what to do with it. She is a restorer and bookbinder, so I think she is.
Oh, well, then I think that's a perfect home for it.
But that was my question, and thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you for the call. We'll go on next to someone in Urbana on line number three. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hello. There are two or three or perhaps four print shops in town that print photographs, even digital photographs, with the old projection method. So essentially the print is a photographic print. It's my assumption that these would have better lasting quality, and it's my opinion they're better quality prints. Am I right in supposing they do endure better?
In most cases, yes, but not in all cases. The color photography, true color photography, not digital photography, but the true chemical process of making a color photograph.
Right. That's what I'm referring to.
Yes. Actually is still a dye-based process, and many of us, if we look back at our family color photographs, have noticed a significant color shift, frequently into the yellows or the magenta colors. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of my family pictures are kind of have this odd odd pinkish tone to mm-hmm. them now. And that's because the chemistry behind the preponderance of color photography, which is called the chromogenic process, mm-hmm. is dye-based. And those dyes are unstable, particularly due to light damage. But high relative humidity and high temperatures also exacerbate that color shift. So the pigment-based process that I was talking about and certain photographic processes, which are exceedingly uncommon and used only in art prints, are more stable long term. So the quality of the photograph is really as dependent upon your camera as it is upon the printer until you get to really cheap printers. With cheap inkjets, you can really see that it was done on a cheap inkjet. But the quality of the image itself, how many DPI was that image captured at, is going to be very evident in a high quality photograph. If you took a photograph that had a really low resolution, that's going to be evident in a good quality photograph. But if you've got a good quality digital image and you're printing it out with a high quality photographic, either printer or a true photographic process, you should end up with a pretty crisp looking image. But again, pigment based production is going to be more stable than anything that's dye based. But in general, yes, true photographic prints are going to be more stable than a lot of the inkjet prints that are available, which are the ones that are most commonly available to folks.
It's a bit more expensive.
Yes, but I think it's worth it.
I would agree. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. So the black and white photographs that resonate in our minds remain sharp after so much time, much more sharp than color photos.
Indeed. The chemistry behind a black and white photograph is a lot more stable. It broke my heart when the director of the Image Permanence Institute up in Rochester, which is one of the major research institutions for photographic preservation, declared black and white photography dead. And that it's really only an art form now, that nobody is using it to make family photographs anymore.
There's something wonderful about black and white, though.
Indeed.
You know, just working with, and actually, that's how I learned photography
mm-hmm.
was,
oh,
you
yeah,
know,
I did
actually,
too.
Yeah, doing the whole darkroom thing and enlarging. And yeah. It's a craft. It's an alchemy kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah. They're not immune. There is a lot of deterioration that can happen with black and white photographs as well, unfortunately. But it is a much more stable form, and the deterioration is usually a lot less severe than we see in color prints.
Well, I think what people believe is they believe that, you know, if something is older, it's more fragile. But mm-hmm. in this case, you know, the newer, you know, color is actually mm-hmm. much more unstable than the older black and white form.
And those aren't even as stable as, say, a tintype. Yeah. I mean, those are... You could
yeah, we run into this all the time, like in plastics. People are like, oh, plastics last forever. They don't. Yeah. They're very unstable. Plastic mm-hmm. is incredibly unstable. I have pieces that are 100,000 years old that are in better shape than modern plastics mm-hmm. in my collection. Mm-hmm. So it's really not a older equals more fragile.
No, absolutely not.
Well, film, for example. You know, we're dealing with now everything digital. You know, video is now digital, mm-hmm. And it's an incredible problem. But when you look at the technology we used to use for moving images, it was film. Film can last for hundreds of years if stored
exactly.
properly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, not so. That's completely untrue with digital anything. So.
Yeah.
Well, we have a couple callers waiting patiently. Actually, our lines are all full, so we'll go on next to someone in Champaign on line number one. Good morning.
Hi there.
Yes.
I have, it's a woven basket. It actually was, my dad made it as a Boy Scout. It's about 65 years old, and it was meant as a backpack. So it's white ash, and it's large. It's probably 3 feet tall by maybe a foot and a half wide. And it's becoming brittle with age. The wood is in long strips that are maybe 2 inches long. And I wasn't quite sure if there's a way to keep it a little more supple or pliable.
Okay, so I get a tough one. not really. I mean, pretty much, you know, where are you storing it right now?
I have it up in a guest bedroom, sort of it's a darker room where the shades aren't open that often.
Excellent. Good choice. Is it near any type of vent or anything like that?
No.
Okay. For the most part, what I would recommend is that you give it a light brushing for sure. So, you know, go through and actually brush it off and then vacuum, you know, that, you know, you want to keep it clean. That's really important. And as far as, you know, making it more supple, it just, it's, you know, we're in central Illinois. In the winter, it gets really, really dry. And then in the summer, it gets really, really warm. What happened, you know, moist. What happens is that the wood is hygroscopic. So it's going to release moisture and gain moisture over time. So what happens is after something that's 65 years old, it loses that elasticity and that ability to be able to do that. So I would just say handle it very little. If it's dirty, you know, use a soft brush to brush it off. You want to make sure that you keep it clean and you're keeping it in the right place.
Mm-hmm. What about support, okay. Krista?
You can do some type of support to it. Like if it's collapsing, what we generally do is kind of put a pillow inside of it. And okay. So we take, you know, like unresonated polyfill. And you could get that at the fabric store. And you can use a soft cotton that's not, you know, like a muslin and that kind of thing. And you can stuff the inside, so...
Well, I don't know. Sometimes with caned chairs, like if the seats are caned, they'll say spray with water or something to sort of keep them more supple. But maybe with something this old, that's not.
Well, you don't. It doesn't. What it does is it just swells it over time, and eventually, when it gets dry again in the winter, it's just going to release that moisture, and eventually, it's going to lose that elasticity. What happens is when a cell wall, when a plant cell wall is alive, it's able to absorb and, you know, contract and be able to pull nutrients through the plant. When it's made into something, the plant is dead, it can't do that anymore. So there's only a certain amount of times. So when you're spraying your cane chair, yeah, it swells it, but it can also cause mold and also bring bugs into it. So you don't really want to do that.
Okay, I won't do that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the call. Next up, someone in Decatur on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, good morning. I've got something called archival gold CDs. They're advertised as being 300-year life or 24-karat gold. Your opinion on those?
Jack might chime in on this one, too, since this is his bailiwick as well. Generally, as far as CD quality goes, those are certainly a better quality CD than a lot of the mass-produced ones that you can pick up at, say, Office Max or whatever. I mean, you've definitely invested in, no pun intended, like the gold standard CD. They are by far one of the best quality CDs. The challenge with those is not so much the failure of the CD itself, but then you're looking at, you know, how long are you hoping to access that data off the CD? Because you're still going to be subject to having to migrate that information, because whatever platform or program it was written in is probably not going to be viable in, say, 10 or 20 years. So the fact that the CD may last 300 years is almost a moot point, because we're not going to have any technology to be able to read the information off of it. What's good is that you don't have to worry about your CD failing and having data loss off the CD, which is excellent. So you're mitigating one of the challenges of digital preservation, but you still have to look at migrating that data forward in different programs. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Jack.
Well, I would say storage is also really important. Yeah. How you store your CDs. I was seeing an advertisement for, it was a catalog, these binders with the plastic sleeves you slip the CDs into. That's one of the worst things you can do, mm-hmm. because the plastic will stick to the surface of the CD and either come off or rip off some of the surface of the actual disc.
Indeed.
So by storing it in this wonderful binder, you are actually destroying it over time.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've had some experience with that ourselves, actually.
Oh, no.
So, yeah. But, you know, there are differences in quality of CDs, to be sure. It's just not something that 30 years from now, we think of photographs that we have from a couple centuries ago. We have film from 100 years ago. We're not going to have CDs 50, 100 years from now.
Right.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. All right, next up, we have several people waiting. We'll go on next to a listener in Sycamore, line number 4. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I think you partially answered my question about CD quality, because I was curious to know what actually happens to CDs when they are stored over time in a careful environment. And when you mentioned storing them in sleeves, I'd store them in the larger jewel cases, which you can buy in quantity, that seems to leave their surfaces unaffected. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that, please?
Jewel cases come in different qualities, and it's going to depend somewhat. As Krista pointed out, plastics are inherently unstable, and there are a lot of decent plastics out there, and there are a lot of bad plastics out there. The harder the polyethylene cases and polypropylene cases are likely to be the most preservation-friendly jewel cases. In general, if you're looking at really long-term storage, what we in the library use are sleeves with a material called corrosion intercept, which is basically a barrier that helps to guard against the metal corrosion in the information-carrying layer in the CD, and otherwise they're good quality paper. Generally, paper is going to be a more stable storage environment than any plastic, although I said the polypropylene and polyethylene is generally a good stable plastic. If it doesn't, when you buy a jewel case, if it doesn't tell you what plastic it's made out of, chances are it's not a good quality plastic. And if it's not a good quality plastic, that can actually be speeding up, like Jack mentioned with the sleeves, be speeding up deterioration of them. Even under good storage, one of the things you're going to have to worry about, too, is called bit rot. And that's sort of a dramatic phrase. But what it basically means is that not due necessarily to the physical media deteriorating, but the data itself, the ones and zeros that make up the data, over time just slowly begins to corrupt. And this is very, very common. I shouldn't say very, very common, but it happens. It happens on a fairly frequent basis. And so for those of us who are managing large-scale digital preservation, what we do is run our digital materials through programs called checksums, which basically just say, okay, when we brought the data in and it was new, this is exactly what the sequence of ones and zeros looked like. And then it compares the data on storage to that original file over and over and over again to ensure the data isn't changing over time. And when it does, it basically pings us and says, hey, you have some file corruption here or some data corruption.
It's like a fingerprint
exactly.
for the file. And if you have several copies of the file, you know that one of them's gone a little bit corrupt. So you can do something about that.
Right. And it goes back to that multiple copies thing.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We have a few minutes left. Let me just reintroduce our guest this morning, Jennifer Hain-Tepper, head of the Preservation and Conservation Program at the University of Illinois Library, and Krista D.C. Quinn, Collections Manager at the Spurlock Museum. We're talking about preserving your family artifacts. We're also going to mention once again the Preservation Emporium this Saturday, April 21st, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Spurlock Museum. And this is another chance to talk with Jennifer and Krista and a whole bunch of other experts on a lot of different topics. So you can bring your artifacts in, and they'll give you some guidance. And there's a keynote address at 2 p.m. on Breaking New Ground and the Concept of Cemetery Preservation by Holly Libisky. And so that's coming up this weekend. And we have a few minutes left. Let's carry on and take some more calls.
Great. Sounds good.
Next up, someone on line number 3 in Lovington. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, good morning. I have a question about tintypes. Mm-hmm. I inherit tintypes?
Yes.
I inherited my grandmother's old velvet album with the very thick pages in it, and in the back are about 6 tintypes. They seem to be holding up very well. Is there anything special I should do with them?
Generally, tintypes are really stable. The photographic process that produced tintypes isn't prone to deterioration the way a lot of modern photographic images are. The important things to keep in mind with tintypes, first off, is that they're actually not made of tin. They're on iron. So they are very susceptible to high humidity. I know, it's a misnomer.
Who knew?
So you want to be sure to keep them away from high humidity because they can rust because they are iron, and this can result not only in rust along the edges, but eventually it can actually make the emulsion, the image layer, bubble as the rust develops underneath the emulsion. So you want to be really careful about high humidity with them. They're also susceptible to having the emulsion, the image layer, peel off if there's any sort of abrasion. If you have these in an album, I think that's exceedingly unlikely. But for them, for many of us, we may find them and they're loose. And then you want to be sure to put them somewhere where they're not going to be rattling around or sliding against other objects, because the bonding of that image layer to the metal is reasonably strong, but not as strong as a lot of paper processes. And so you need to be real careful that you don't end up chipping image or delaminating image off of the iron base. But humidity is going to be your number one concern.
All right. These leaves in this album are very thick, and they don't touch anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they're in the pages, they're just there free. So I guess they've lasted this long.
Yeah, no, you've got one of the most stable photographic processes there was there. So I think keeping them in the album and just making sure that in general the album is stored somewhere dry and dark is going to be your best preservation.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We have several other callers waiting. We may have time for others. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, or toll-free anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We'll go to a listener in Bement next on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just a quick comment. For many years in the woodworking community, there's something called polyethylene glycol, and it's used to soak green wood in, and I know the Smithsonian has used it for other processes in the biological field, because when I was a student at the University of Washington, I worked with a Smithsonian biologist on the project. But it adds moisture. It pulls moisture out of the air and will keep things like wood or plant fiber material moist without rotting. Just a comment. I'll go offline. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I know they frequently use PEG for waterlogged archaeological specimens.
Yeah, that's true, too. But, I mean, sometimes that's not available to the home listener. Of course, if you want to, rehydrate something and you want to look at that, you can always see a professional conservator. You can go to the American Institute of Conservators, look into that. As we keep going on and on, environment's your most important thing.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the resources that we could point people to, like if they want to learn more about some of this stuff? You know, whether it's paper or photos, do we have some pointers?
Sure. One of the best I know book and paper. I'm sure Krista can speak more to objects.
Yeah.
One of the clearinghouses is a website called COOL, which is Conservation Online, which is hosted by the American Institute for Conservation that Krista just alluded to. If you just Google conservation and COOL or Conservation Online, you'll find it. But it's a great clearinghouse for both public information as well as professional information for conservators and preservation professionals. The AIC's website also is really useful, which is, I know that one off the top of my head, it's conservation-us.org. Otherwise, as far as book and paper and photographs go, both the Library of Congress, the National Archives, as well as the Canadian Conservation Institute in Canada have really, really great public interfaces.
And the CCI does have great. Canadian Conservation Institute has great interfaces for objects, as well as the National Park District.
Ooh, yes.
Has conservograms, which are very easy to read for objects.
Yeah, the National Park Service did a really, really good job with those.
Great. Well, our lines are full, so let's carry on. Next up, a listener in Champaign, line number two. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Couple of questions. One is, I have quite an extensive 2x2 35mm slide collection. That part of it is for my home use of family, and the other half of it is for professional use. Now, I've been converting the professional use part, digitizing it for PowerPoint presentations. Now, with the conversation you're giving me on digital, I'm wondering, would I be better off, as long as I can maintain carousel projectors that work, and in other words, buy up some to use over the next 50 years, would I be better not to convert the family 35mm slides because some are now 60, 70 years old and they look very good. They're Kodachrome and Ektachrome.
Right. Yeah, you are basically a great illustration of one of the first migrations of technology change, because very few of us have slide carousels anymore, kind of like very few of us have motion picture projectors anymore either. But the stability of the object itself is very similar. These are both printed on polyester film. Kodachrome and Ektachrome in particular are exceedingly stable color processes. When I keep talking about the instability of color photography, I'm excluding actually Ektachrome and Kodachrome, because the science behind that color image is way, way, way more stable. And I would say that I think you're touching on a truth here, that if you were looking to digitize them and then get rid of the slides, I do not think that would be a good preservation step, because the slides are definitely going to be way more stable over the long term without active participation from you. Conversion to digital is going to require constant migration and checking and backing up. That said, access to 35mm and 2-inch slides is becoming increasingly more difficult. And you might consider digitization because it certainly would make sharing and viewing those slides a whole lot easier. And this is something that the library constantly does, is we do digitize very, very much of our content for access purposes, not for preservation. Digital is a wonderful tool for sharing and viewing information. So I certainly don't mean to discourage you from digitization, but I would discourage you certainly from throwing out those original slides.
Oh, thank you. Well, one of the ways I've figured out in terms of, because I have about 6,000 slides of each type, my profession and my family. And for the family ones, I've been putting them in carousel cassettes that are pre-packaged, so to speak, for Christmas time and for vacation time, mm-hmm. and so forth. So they're really easy to show because they're already pre-selected and pre-packaged. Now, I've got the professional slides digitized, probably 3,000 of those, and so they're on my computer for presentations, laptop. So they do get into my car periodically and so forth. And what are the problems of say getting them in the car overheated, for example? Does that impact a PowerPoint presentation?
It has the potential. I mean, if your car gets really, really hot, excessive heat can damage just about anything. I don't know of any examples. It depends how you're storing the PowerPoint presentation. Certainly, if you're looking at it on a CD, extreme heat and light exposure could be damaging. But
no, it's on the hard drive of my laptop.
Oh, a hard drive.
Yeah. I mean, extreme heat still can do some
oh, yeah.
nasty damage
absolutely.
To a hard drive.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So, I mean, it depends upon longevity. It's a risk. I would avoid the risk if you can.
So, in other words, always take it out and carry it with me. All right.
Not storing it in a hot car is generally probably
storing,
a risk.
But let's say I'm out for a couple of hours and it would get hot.
I would try to avoid it whenever you can.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And we just we're almost out of time here, but I want to add that there are different qualities of hard drives, just as there are different qualities of paper and CDs and everything mm-hmm. else. So there's some that are really made. You know, there's some that actually you can immerse in water. I wouldn't recommend that for most
of
them.
Okay, let's not do that.
Right. But, yeah, so it varies drastically. And so how you store the hard drive, I mean, it's a physical medium as well.
Exactly.
It is made of metal and magnetic.
And plastics.
And motors. And it's got a whole bunch of components that can all deteriorate. So mm-hmm. a hard drive is definitely not a preservation kind of medium.
No.
Unfortunately. Well, we're at the end of our time, and I'm sorry that we're leaving several people waiting with questions, but I guess we'll just have to take that as our cue to do this again.
Or maybe they can come to the Emporium on Saturday and talk to us there.
That'd be great. Why don't you just give the wrap-up about that?
Well, we have an Emporium. It's going to be from 1 to 4 at the Spurlock Museum. Come and visit experts who will be able to advise you on preservation of your collections. And we also have a keynote speaker, Holly Lubinsky, correct, who will be talking about
cemetery and monument preservation.
That's right. And that's 1 to 4 p.m. this coming Saturday at the Spurlock Museum.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there. Our guests again, Jennifer Hain-Tepper, Head of Preservation and Conservation at the University of Illinois Library, and Krista D.C. Quinn of the Spurlock Museum. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
My pleasure.